Not only did I join the wrestling sisterhood, but I become a character just like my great aunt.
And if you could run a 100-yard dash in 10 seconds or less, you got out of remedial PE. I never got out of remedial PE.
Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne. How about a couple of sports stories today? We like sports stories because they're always high-stakes struggles between committed opponents. They look a little bit like epic battles between good and evil. There are winners and losers. There are Davids and Goliaths. There are underdogs and Cinderellas, but they're just games, right? Well, we'll share with you a couple of stories from a couple of storytellers whose lives were impacted by interactions with games. We start with Geraldine Buckley, who became a passionate fan of TV wrestling, thanks to her great aunt, Eileen. Here's Geraldine with a story called Devil on Horseback.
When I was seven, my great aunt Eileen, my mother's aunt, came to live with us in the seaside town where we lived in the north of England. Everyone always said about my great aunt Eileen, "Oh, Eileen is such a character." And when I was seven, I had absolutely no idea what that meant, but it sounded rather marvellous. So I decided I was going to be a character too, just like my great aunt. Well, my great-aunt Eileen had been born in the Isle of Man. That's a small island between the north coast of England and Ireland. And her whole history, like that island, seemed to be surrounded by Irish mist. In other words, you could never quite get hold of it. But I did know a few things about my aunt. I knew, for example, that she really liked dogs, and that she kept a large pack of very aristocratic, very highly strung Afghan hounds in a very small house. And then I knew that for a time that she'd come over here to America from England, and she had been the secretary to the editor of the New York Times. And then I also knew that in our family, my great-aunt Eileen had a reputation as a smuggler. I'm afraid it's true. One time she was coming from America to England by ship, and she smuggled a talking parrot into the country in a large handbag. Well, you can imagine the conversation in the cabin. "Polly, I don't want you to say another word until we're through customs. That means no spitting, no squawking, and no swearing. Do you understand me?" "Yes, Aunt Eileen." Well, clearly the parrot did hear and did obey, because my great-aunt Eileen never got into any trouble. But I knew my great-aunt Eileen long after her smuggling days were over. She was in the last few years of her life. She was badly crippled with rheumatoid arthritis. Her feet were very misshapen. They wouldn't fit into ordinary shoes, so she had to shuffle along in big brown men's slippers with the help of a cane. But her mind was still really bright, and so was her great love of sports. Now, my great-aunt Eileen's favourite sport was wrestling. This wasn't the modern, flashy American wrestling. Oh, no, no, no. It was the much more benign, by comparison, English wrestling of the mid to late 60s. My great-aunt Eileen loved to watch on the television, and they were on at 10:30 on a Wednesday and then also on a Saturday afternoon. I loved to watch with her. Well, of course, the Wednesday at 10:30 was far too, it was far too late for me. So my mother would come in and she'd say goodnight to me, and she'd say prayers with me and say goodnight, darling. And I'd say goodnight, mommy, and I would go to sleep. And then my mother would go off to work with my father. They had started up a restaurant in the seaside town, and my father was a chef. He would cook there and my mother did the front of house. And we had a secret, my great-aunt Eileen and I, because just before 10:30, my great-aunt Eileen would come and wake me up. And I'd come down with her and watch the wrestling. It was our secret. No one ever knew about it. And then, of course, I'd always watch with her on a Saturday afternoon. I was entranced by those heaving, grunting warriors. There was Mick McManus. He was the one that everyone loved to hate. And then there was Ricky Starr. He was an ex-ballet dancer. So he would pirouette around the ring, completely flummox his beefy opponent, and then when the man was standing there in shock, he'd flip into the canvas, get him in a half Nelson and win the match. But my favourite were a clean-shaven tag team called the Royal Brothers. Now, somehow, my great-aunt Eileen had managed to befriend these wrestlers. So whenever they were fighting in the area, they would always come and have a glass with Auntie, as they call her, a glass of sherry. Well, Bert was the older one. When he wasn't fighting, he was a hairdresser in Bolton. And Bert was his younger brother. Bert was 21. He had broad shoulders, blue piercing eyes, soft blonde hair. And he'd come into the house and he'd say, "Hello, Geraldine." He'd say, "How are you?" And I'd think, "Oh, he's noticed me. He said hello to me." And I never told anyone, but when I was 10, I had such a crush on Vic. I'd watch him as he was sipping his sherry and I'd think to myself, "Oh, Vic, don't get married. Wait for me. Wait for me." Well, one day, my great-aunt Eileen told me she had tickets for the two of us to go and see the Royal Brothers fight at Blackpool Tower. Now, Blackpool Tower was very famous in the north of England because it had a circus, a resident circus, headed up by a clown called Charlie Caroli. And when that circus was on vacation, they'd put a wrestling ring right there in the middle of the circus ring. And I'd been there one time before with my aunt. Now, my aunt was, she really was a respectable figure. Respectable she was, despite the smuggling. But in the middle of one of these matches, she turned into a yelling, screaming hoyden. She was on her feet. Her grey, wiry hair was sticking on edge, and she was shaking her stick at the referee, and she was saying, "Referee, can't you see what he's doing? Do you need glasses? Do you want to borrow mine?" And all over that circus rings, little old ladies were doing the same thing. Blue, pink and white hairs were bobbing like buoys in a storm. And their owners were yelling things like, "Hit him! Hurt him! Make him bleed!" And then there was one lady who looked the spitting image of my religious education teacher, the one who just last week had taught us about Samson. But it couldn't have been her. It had to be her twin sister. Because this one was yelling, "Gouge his eyes out! Gouge his eyes out!" And then other people were yelling things that sounded rude, but I wasn't quite sure what they meant. So this upcoming visit presented me with a bit of a problem, because I knew I had to find something to shout that was rude, but not too rude. Well, I thought about it for days, and the solution came in an unlikely place. My parents had got a new menu in their restaurant, and under starters, I found it. It said, "Devils on horseback, prunes wrapped in bacon." I thought, that's it, that's it, that's what I'll shout. So the day came, the event started with lights, drama, and a strong whiff of the circus that had last been in this space. Well, the opening bouts went fine, and then it was the Royal Brothers' time. Well, the first half of the match went without incident, and then it happened. Mick McManus, the baddie, was thumping Vic out of sight of the referee. Well, Bert, his brother, was doing everything he could to lean over those ropes to tag him to take over, but he was too far away. The crowd were on their feet. They were yelling. My aunt was screaming. I thought, this is my moment. I stood up, and with all the passion in my 10-year-old heart, I cried out, "Get off him, you devil on horseback!" "Oh," said my aunt, "that was good." "Oh," said her friends who were in all the seats around, "Oh, Eileen, she's a chip off the old block. She's become quite a character." Yes! I'd done it. Not only had I joined the wrestling sisterhood, but I'd become a character just like my great aunt. Well, the moment passed. We all sat back down on our seats. The Royal Brothers won. And somehow I knew I had not let my heroes down. I had been part of their victory. And victory tasted good.
That was Geraldine Buckley with "Devil on Horseback." Listening to sports stories reminds me of a letter I got from my dad when I was a young man. I just left home to do missionary work in Argentina. Now, the work was important to me. I wanted that experience to be part of my life. But I wondered if I'd do a good job. I knew I'd miss the people I loved while I was gone. I was nervous about a lot of things. And I was going to be gone for a long time. And this was before cell phones, before email, before social media, before the internet really had made communication instantaneous. So letters from my family and friends were a couple of weeks in getting to me, usually by boat. That's how old I am. Anyway, in those first few weeks of missionary work, I was hungry for news from home, and I was glad to get a letter from my dad. And in the letter, my dad, who wasn't an avid sports fan, talked about sports. He compared life to a game in which there are fans in the stands and also players on the field. And everyone in the arena, players and fans alike, live some and die some with the ups and downs of the game. Everyone's invested in what's going on. But while the fans in the stands can feel the rise and fall of the game's fortunes pretty keenly, it's the players on the field who are really taking the blows, running the yards, tasting the blood, sliding in the dirt, bearing the real weight of a loss, or feeling the real exhilaration of a win. And there's nothing wrong with being a fan, my dad said. But when it came to my missionary work, he wanted in his letter to honor what he considered my decision to be a player on the field in a venture that was important to me, and not just a fan in the stands. Well, I wasn't much of a sports fan either in those days, but I got the metaphor. And the letter became important to me during that time of missionary work and in the rest of my life, too. I've kept it close any time I have an opportunity to stay safely in the stands and cheer or to get off the bench and into the game. You know, I've played some of both roles in my life, as surely you have too, and I like both roles. But I think I can say with my dad that the big triumphs have come on the field and not in the stands. Anyway, that's where Geraldine's sports story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? Our next story is from Donald Davis, who found golf to make a difference in his life, if only that it got him out of remedial PE. But as you might expect with a Donald Davis story, there's a little more to it than that. Here's Donald with a story he calls The Golf Team.
In 1962, I was graduated from high school, and I went off to Davidson College. Some people say to me once in a while, did you play a sport in college? I did, and I want to tell you the story of that. During freshman orientation, I kept hearing kids talk about something called the cake race, the freshman cake race, the cake race. I didn't know what that was, but pretty soon we were going to find out what it was. It was a tradition at Davidson College that had gone on for years and years and years. And this was the tradition. On the afternoon in question, all the freshmen would gather up in the middle of the football stadium. All the faculty wives, the faculty at that time was all male, so it was not spouses, it was just about 100 wives, would all make cakes. And those cakes would all be on tables out there in the middle of the football field where we could walk around and look at them. And then a gun was going to go off, and we were going to have the freshman cake race, which would go across the soccer field, down along a lot of the cross-country course, out onto a place called Gray Road, up Gray Road to Concord Road, way back around the campus, and about 3 miles later would end up coming back into the football field. And as people came in and entered, they'd be given numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, as you entered in your order all the way through. And then when it was all settled down and over with, the person who had number 1 who had finished first got to pick the first pick of any cake they wanted. And then number 2 got any cake they wanted, any cake they wanted. It was going to be great. We were all going to get a cake. We were not good at math. There were 250 of us who were freshmen and only 100 faculty wives. So most of us were losers to start with. Well, the gun went off, and never in my life had I ever been in a race competing with other people except with my little brother whom I could easily outrun. So I had no idea how to go about running a 3-mile race. So I started, as soon as the gun went off, running absolutely as fast as I could. And you know what? I was ahead of a lot of people. I was ahead of a lot of people down across the soccer field. I was ahead of a lot of people going way down the cross-country track. And then about the time we got to Gray Road and we turned back uphill after going downhill so far, I wasn't ahead of a lot of people anymore. And about every 10 steps going up that long, drawn-out uphill run, somebody else came by, and somebody else came by, and somebody else came by. And pretty soon, it was very clear to me that the cakes were all run out by now. And I got slower and slower and slower. And by the time I came back onto that football field, not only were the cakes, you know, won, most of them were given out and eaten by now. Well, it was an interesting scene when you came back onto the football field. The whole athletic department was assembled there on the field, and the cross-country coach was, of course, grabbing the people who had won the freshman cake race, recruiting them for the cross-country team. The track coach was next. He was grabbing all the next finishers, signing them up for something to be on the track, you know, on the track team. Pretty soon it was the soccer coach. He was grabbing everybody who was next. And then pretty soon all the coaches had everybody they wanted. And here was the rest of us. And we were placed in what was kindly called remedial physical education. We had a requirement of, physical education requirement. And if you're on a team, that took care of it. You know, so all those fast runners, they were now, you know, in cross country for their PE requirement. The soccer players, that was their PE requirement all the way through. And I was in remedial PE. Well, we would go to PE class 3 times each week. And the way remedial PE worked was, the whole athletic faculty sort of rotated taking that class on. And so one week it might be the swim coach. We didn't know it's going to be the swim coach, so we didn't have swim trunks. We had to take off all the clothes and just swim naked for an hour. And then the next class it could be the soccer coach. And our whole instructions for the hour were go outside and run till you throw up. And then it might be the cross-country coach, and we'd have to run around the cross-country track. Or it might be the football coach, and we'd have to throw footballs back and forth. Or one time we jumped on trampolines for an hour till somebody fell off the side and got hurt, and we didn't get to do that anymore. Well, every week on Friday, you got to go run a 100-yard dash. And if you could run a 100-yard dash in 10 seconds or less, you got out of remedial PE. I never got out of remedial PE. All the way through the first semester, and I had another whole semester of it facing me after Christmas time. Well, just before going home for Christmas, I was down in the gym one day, and there was a poster on the side that said, anyone who wants to sign up for the golf team, report to the gym on a certain day in January when we came back from Christmas. My daddy played golf, and I thought, he's got golf clubs, he's got old golf clubs, and he's got new golf clubs. If I can get him to give me his old golf clubs, I'll sign up for the golf team, and then I'll be on a team, and I won't be in remedial PE anymore. I had no idea that sign up for the golf team meant you already knew how to play golf. It just said, sign up for the golf team. I had no idea that there were students there with me who had won, you know, golf tournaments and golf championships and had been on high school teams, on private school teams all over the place. All I knew was if I signed up for the golf team, I might get out of remedial PE. And so when I was home at Christmas, I told my dad, I said, I'm going to sign up for the golf team. And he gave me his old golf clubs, and he even gave me, I didn't even know they existed, these shoes that had cleats in the bottom of them. I said, what are those? He says, you wear those when you're on the golf team. They keep you from slipping on the golf course. And I took the shoes and the golf clubs with me when I went back after Christmas, and I was just waiting for that first day to come along. It came along, and I put my golf shoes on in the dorm room and walked down to the gym. I discovered that's not what I was supposed to do. Walk into the gym wearing golf shoes. And after some vocabulary that was directed at me, I took the golf shoes off and carried them barefoot back to my dorm room and came back with my tennis shoes on. Well, we all got signed up, and the plan was made. We were going to go. It was about 6 miles up to where the golf course was, and we all went up there with Coach Harry Fogelman. Coach Fogelman, we got up there, and he divided us into foursomes, and I got to put the golf shoes back on. And we all played golf with the foursome, and you know, watching what the rest of them did, I just kind of tried to do what the rest of them did. And when that first round of golf was over, he divided everybody up again into new foursomes, except for me. And he said, "You may play with me." And so while everybody else went out and played their next round of golf, I played with the coach. And I hit it a lot more times than he did, too. And we got through with our round, and he said, "Now, it's real brave of you to come out for the golf team. And I have a little plan that I think will be best for you to follow through the course of the semester." And we went in the clubhouse, and he got out 18 scorecards. There were 18 weeks left until school got out for the summer. And he went ahead and he signed all 18 scorecards and gave them to me. And he said, "Now here's what I want you to do. Tuesday is a good day. Wednesday is a good day because the golf course isn't very busy on Tuesday and Wednesday." He said, "But I want you by yourself, not with anybody else, but by yourself to come up to the golf course and play a round of golf by yourself and fill out the scorecard and then slide it under the door of my office. And I want you to do that each week for this whole semester." And that's what I did. All by myself, every Tuesday, I played a round of golf and I figured out in triple digits what the score was, and I slipped it under his door, and I never saw Coach Fogelman for the entire semester except one more time. It was 2/3 of the way through that semester when I got a letter, and the letter said that on a certain day at a certain hour, pictures would be made for the yearbook, and the golf team was to have its picture made at that certain time, and I showed up. And if you look at the Davidson College annual for the year 1963, you'll see my picture standing with everybody else on the golf team. That dear sweet man took care of me. Did I play a sport in college? Yes, I did. I was on the golf team.
That was Donald Davis with the golf team. Has anyone made the kind of difference in your life that Donald's golf team coach made in his, or that my dad made in mine? Do they know they've made that difference? Have you ever made a decision to get out of the stands and into the game in a way that has rewarded you? Do you have a lucky shirt or something like that that you're convinced helps your team to win? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. We might share them on the show. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed@byu.edu. We want to thank Geraldine Buckley and Donald Davis for sharing their stories with us today. You've listened to their stories. Now it's time to share some of your own. If you love the Appleseed, check out Wink, Stories for Better Bedtimes. It's another BYU Radio podcast we think you'll love. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.